Berrigan Lecture was conceived in 1999 to honor Father Dan Berrigan. Dan Berrigan, as you know, is the founder of International House, now called Ignatian House. But more importantly, Dan is one of the great peacemakers of our time, in the same category as Dorothy Day and Gandhi, Dr. King, and Cesar Chavez. Dan Berrigan continually challenged and challenges his friends and all of us to literally not do nothing in the face of the overwhelming problems that face our nation and indeed our world. And also to go about nonviolently, but publicly and firmly, to challenge those who would choose war making in any of its forms over peacemaking. For as Dan would surely remind us tonight, blessed are the peacemakers. The Dan Berrigan Lecture Endowment was created to bring on an annual basis a peacemaker like Daniel Berrigan to campus, not only to inspire us, but to challenge us all, the Lemoyne community and the greater Syracuse community, to not do nothing in the face of injustice. And so, in that tradition, in that vein, we have with us today Dr. Howard Zinn. Perhaps Howard is best known as the author of The People's History of the United States, which has sold 1.4 million copies in the 20 years that it's been in publication. And I found out this evening that in a rare instance in publishing, it actually sells more books every year than it had the year before. Well, it's a remarkable text that I know is used in classrooms around the country. Howard was a vocal opponent of the Vietnam War and traveled to Vietnam, North Vietnam, with Father Daniel Berrigan to bring home several American POWs. He has taught thousands, I would think, of students between his time at Spelman College in Atlanta and Boston University. And you know, just to give you a sense of how well known Howard Zinn is, today we brought him to his hotel after picking him up from the airport, and we're checking in at the front desk, and Howard said to the front desk clerk, I'm Howard Zinn, and he said, oh, I reckon that Howard, and the front desk clerk was about a young man about 25 years old. Said, oh, I recognize you. I recognized you when you came in. Oh, really? How did you recognize me? Well, I went to, do you remember what college it was? LaSalle University, which is near Boston, and Howard talked to me, lives near there, and the young man mentioned, yes, I remember seeing you at a panel discussion when I was in college, and you did a good job. Howard's fame precedes him. With all that, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Howard Zinn.
Thank you. I especially appreciate it. Real honor to be asked to give the Daniel Berrigan Lecture. And as Michael indicated, I got to know Dan Berrigan in early 1968. Under very unusual circumstances. It was a time of the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, also a time of the Tet Holiday for the Vietnamese. And I was teaching a seminar at Boston University, and somebody came into my seminar room, very rude, and said, there's a phone call for you. You don't usually interrupt a teacher in a seminar by a phone call. You know, maybe it's a marketeer. I mean, who knows? He said, no, this is really important. You've got to. So I told my class I'll be back. I went to the phone in the office, and on the other end of the phone was Dave Dellinger. Some of you may recognize him as a longtime leader of the anti-war movement in the United States. And he said, the North Vietnamese are about to release three American airmen, prisoners of war. This is the first release of captured airmen by the North Vietnamese. They're doing this as a sort of a gesture at the time of their Tet Holiday, and they want an American representative from the peace movement to come to North Vietnam, to come to Hanoi, to pick up these prisoners and bring them back to what? didn't say to civilization. Bring them back to the United States. And so, will you go? I said, well, when? Tomorrow morning. So I called my wife and told her I won't be home for lunch tomorrow. That morning I packed my bags, flew to New York, and there in an apartment in Greenwich Village was Daniel Berrigan, whom I didn't know. I knew Phil Berrigan. Phil Berrigan and I had been on a platform together speaking against the war, but I had never met Dan Berrigan. I knew he was a poet. I knew he was teaching at Cornell. And so we met for the first time. And then we hopped on a plane that afternoon and traveled halfway around the world to North Vietnam. Well, we actually didn't get to North Vietnam immediately because we were held up in Laos because the Tet Offensive had closed up the airport in Saigon, and this little funny airplane left over from World War II, an airplane that belonged to the International Control Commission, which made 6 flights a month from Saigon to Phnom Penh in Cambodia to Vientiane in Laos to Hanoi, made 6 flights a month, and we thought we were going to connect with it in Vientiane, but it had never been able to leave the Thon Son Nhut Airport in Saigon because the Viet Cong offensive had made the airport inoperable. So Dan and I then spent a week in Laos, which was like waiting for the plane that would take us to Hanoi. It was a week, like a week spent in Casablanca, in a spy capital of the world. Every country in the world, even countries that didn't recognize one another, had an embassy in Laos. And it was just a nest of intrigue, and Dan and I loved it. We stayed in a hotel on the Mekong River, and we walked the streets. And I remember once a Buddhist monk came out of one of the buildings and said he wanted us to come in and talk to his students. And we thought, oh, he knows about us. No, he didn't really know about us. He just spotted 2 Westerners, and he wanted us to talk English to his students because they were studying English. So Dan and I gave a little English lesson. But then we went on. I won't tell you all about the rest of the story, but all of this to say that we became friends, spending a lot of time together on that trip and spending time in Vietnam and going through the air raids in Vietnam. And Dan was in one room in the hotel, and I was in another room, old French hotel left over from the French colonial period. And we had very busy days going everywhere and visiting villages that had been bombed by the American Air Force, which presumably was bombing only military targets, but was bombing tiny peasant villages as far removed as you could possibly imagine from a military target. And we were ducking into air raid shelters every day because Hanoi was being bombed every day by the American Air Force. They seemed not to respect the fact that Dan Berrigan and I were there that they should stop bombing while we're there, just out of courtesy. But no, none of that. And so we spent a lot of time together. At the end of every hectic day, we would get together in one of our rooms, and Dan would pull out a little flask of cognac. He traveled very light. Had virtually nothing with him, but there was a bottle of cognac, you see. And we'd have a little cognac, and then we'd retire in our respective rooms, and then we'd wake up in the morning, and Dan would have a poem that he'd written the night before after, I guess, cognac helps. Although it didn't lead me to write a poem, but every morning he had another poem. anyway, we became great friends. I didn't actually mean to talk so much about Dan Berrigan, but then I realized this is the Dan Berrigan lecture series. I should say something about my relationship with Dan, one of the great men, really. And then when Dan, I'll skip a lot and say, when Dan refused to give himself up when he was finally convicted of, you know, he and a bunch of others, Phil Berrigan, the famous Catonsville Nine, broke into this, well, break in is a little too strong a word. Invaded, maybe, is better. Visited, how's that? Visited a draft board. This was being done in those days, you know, especially by priests and nuns. I mean, Catholics are that way. They break into draft board, a symbolic act against the war and against the draft and against militarism, and burned draft records and destroyed draft records and so on. So they did this at Catonsville. They were convicted. And finally, Dan was supposed to turn himself in, and he disappeared. This is a part of my relationship with him, which is not generally known, but I'm going to let you know about it because you gave me such a warm welcome. If you had applauded for 1 minute less, you would never have heard this. when Phil Berrigan also went underground, refused to turn himself in, but was captured in a church in Manhattan, and during a church meeting, an anti-war church meeting by a remarkable Catholic priest in New York, an anti-war Catholic priest, and there was this anti-war meeting, and I was speaking, and several other people were speaking, and Phil Berrigan had just been captured, hiding in the priest's quarters, but the place was swarming with FBI men who were looking for Dan Berrigan. They thought he would show up. Well, he didn't. While I was on a speaker's platform, a note was passed to me by Liz McAllister telling me where Dan was and could we meet? Well, she actually didn't tell me exactly where he was. Could we meet after the meeting in a Spanish Chinese restaurant in Upper Manhattan? They have those things, you know. New York is a very funny place. Spanish-Chinese restaurant in Upper Manhattan. I would meet with her and Sister Jogues, and they would tell us exactly where Dan was, and because we had to get him out of there, because it turned out he was hiding in a house just across the street from an FBI man. anyway, the upshot of it was Dan was driven to Boston, where I live, and for the next, several months, I and a number of other people sort of became his, you might say, handlers during his underground experience until he was captured by a very inept FBI through no expertise of their own. And but anyway, there's much more to say, but I could take up this whole time talking about my relationship with Dan, an amazing poet, and more than that, an amazing human being. But now with that hour of introduction, a 3 minute talk. what will I talk about? Democracy. In fact, was that advertised as the title of my talk? I was afraid of that. You know, you know, months before you talk, they ask you, what will be the title of your talk? You pull something out, and then you forget what it was, and then you show up and somebody reminds you, this is what you're supposed to talk about. But I will, of course. Whatever, you know, whatever word you pulled out of a hat, I would talk about it. Chemistry. Here's a problem with democracy. Everybody knows we live in a democracy. And that's what America is famous for, right? That's America. How do you define America? We are a democratic country. There are totalitarian countries. There are tyrannical countries. There are dictatorships. But we are a democratic country. Well, that's too simple. It's too easy. It's, you know, it's simplistic. It's like giving an answer true to a true-false question. You know, those ridiculous true-false questions that probably kids still get on exams, you know. America is a democracy, true or false? Sorry, it's more complex than that. The fact that we're not a totalitarian state, the fact that we don't have gulags, although we do have more people in prison than anybody else, just I say that quietly, you know, because we don't want the word to get out. But the United States is not a totalitarian state, and we have a constitution, we have representative government, we have elections, we have a Bill of Rights, we have a certain degree of freedom of speech, and look, here I am. What better proof is there? I can speak to 300 people. Of course, Exxon can speak to 3 million people. Freedom of speech is not just qualitative, it's quantitative. Real question is not, do you have freedom of speech? Because you say, well, in America we have freedom of speech. No, the real question is, how much freedom of speech do you have? How many people can you reach? What are your resources? You know, and when you answer the question that way, it becomes more complicated than the question, do we have freedom of speech or do we not have freedom of speech? How much freedom of speech do you have? And how much democracy do we have? Sure, we fought a revolution against England. England was a monarchy, wow. And so a lot of people thought, well, we defeated the monarchy, now we have a democracy. Not quite. We replaced the elite in Britain that ran the colonies, and we replaced them with a local elite that now ran the colonies, the states, the new United States. One upper class was replaced by another upper class. And sure, now it was an improvement. Now, this whole question of democracy, are we a democracy? Well, it's half true. And part of the half truth that's true is that, yes, now we had representative government. We no longer had a monarchy. But how representative was it? Who were these people who gathered together in Philadelphia in 1787 to form the Constitution? Were they representative of the people in the United States? Where are the black people who were at that time 20% of the population? Where are the working people, farmers who were 80% of the population? They weren't there. Where are the Native Americans who lived in the vicinity, who were part of the continent? They weren't there. Where are the women? Who were half the population, they weren't there. 55 rich white men got together in Philadelphia and formed the Constitution, and they formed the Constitution that would serve the interests of the rich white men of the country. It's important to know that because, you know, the Constitution is deified. Wow, we have a Constitution. These other countries, they don't have constitutions. We have a Constitution. Well, it's nice to have a Constitution. It's better to have a Constitution than no Constitution. But what does it mean? How much reality is there to it? And, no taxation without representation. And now we have representation. Well, then how come there's a rebellion in Western Massachusetts because the farmers in Western Massachusetts in 1786 find out that they are being taxed by a legislature run by rich men in Massachusetts who are going to take away their farms and their homes and their livestock and their land because they can't pay their taxes. They're not being represented. Why are the farmers in Pennsylvania in the 1790s rebelling against the taxes that are laid upon them? And every kid learns in elementary school, well, we fought this revolution because no taxation without representation. The fact is, we're all being taxed without being represented. Do these people up in Congress represent the average taxpayer in this country? Do they represent the interests of the taxpayer? Well, you can find out the answer to that by reading the tax code, which is really pleasant reading. But without reading the tax code, just knowing a little bit about the tax structure of the United States, you would know that the tax system of the United States had always, from the beginning, from the founding fathers on, has favored the rich. We've had a class society. Democracy, to use the word democracy, doesn't do justice to the fact that you live in a class society, a society of rich and poor, and in between, a lot of nervous people who don't know which way they're going, don't know whether tomorrow they're going to be rich or poor, don't know what their future is like. It's a class society. And the legislation that's passed by Congress from the founding fathers on, from that first Congress on, the legislation is class legislation which benefits the rich. There are moments, a few brief moments in American history when there's a little break in that, when you get legislation in favor of the poor or the middle class. Those moments when there are great upheaval in the country, like in the 1930s. Or the 1960s, and then you get Social Security and unemployment insurance, then you get Medicare and Medicaid. But in general, it's a very steady stream of legislation favoring the rich. It's hard to have real democracy in a society that is for of the wealthy classes. Sometime in the 1880s, when the populist movement was rising in the United States, and some of you may know what that was, the farmers' movements all over the country protesting against the banks and the railroads and the way they were being squeezed by the corporations. And one of the great populist leaders from Kansas, Ellen Leese, got up at one of their conventions and said, you know, this is supposed to be a government, you know, of, by, for the people, but no, it's a government of, by, and for Wall Street. That was behind the rise of the populist movement. So yes, democracy needs to be looked at, you know, very carefully, and that arrogance that we tend to develop in this country, we are the great democratic country of the world. We are the best. We are number one. Somebody reminded me, I think Carol Berrigan reminded me when we had a little secret meeting before this at Ignatian House. A lot of secret things go on there, and we had a little discussion. Carol Berrigan said, "Well, isn't it true that among the industrial countries of the world, the United States lags way behind in all of the important measures of social welfare?" Yeah, absolutely true. You know, among the industrial countries of the world, the United States has the greatest gap between rich and poor. Enormous gap between the salaries of CEOs and the salary of the average working man. Among the industrial countries of the world, the United States, in infant mortality, ranks 20th or 25th. Fourth, in healthcare, in education, in literacy, in taking care of old people and taking care of children. Most Americans don't know that, and so we live in a kind of a bubble of confidence that we are the greatest, we are the best. And that's true. You know, we have the most television sets, and we have the most automobiles, and we have the most of so many things, but they're very crucial things that have to do with life. You see, that we are not the best in. And so when we talk about ourselves as a democracy, you know, we ought to understand that. And what is especially dangerous is when you not only begin to think of your country as a pure democracy, unalloyed and uncomplicated, true, false, democracy, true, that's us. When you begin, we're the best and we're the greatest. We're different than all the other countries of the world and better. We are the Yankees. We win all the World Series, almost, you see. But a dangerous thing is when you start with that proposition that you are a liberal, democratic country, And then you decide that everybody else in the world deserves to have the same kind of liberalism and democracy that you have, and that it is your mission as a nation in the world to bring liberal ideas and democracy to other places in the world. Then you become truly dangerous. Then you become a rogue state, prowling all over the world looking for places to make democratic and liberal and ruining them, you know, in the process. And it becomes especially dangerous when you think God has ordained this. God has given you this power, this right. It starts right from the beginning with the Puritans of New England, and and they're a theocratic society. That's before anybody talked about separation of church and state. No separation of church and state there. Church and state will combine to hang the witches of Salem. It's a theocratic society, but the first governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, John Winthrop, talks about the city. We are the city on the hill. We are, somehow God has ordained us to be the city on the hill, which will be, the center of all attention in the world and a model and example for all the world. That idea persisted all through in American history and the invoking of God. In the middle of the 19th century, on the eve of the Mexican War, an editor who wrote about manifest destiny, that it was the manifest destiny. He invoked God. Let me see if I can find. He said, John, his name was John O'Sullivan, and it was right after the United States had annexed Texas. A lot of people forget that a lot of our country has come through annexation. We don't like to think of it that way. We like to think that sort of everybody volunteered to join us. It was like the Indians just they left, and we moved in. We moved into an empty continent. That's the way it looked on the maps. The Louisiana Purchase, it's all empty. Now it's ours. No. Indians, huge numbers of them, lived there. And in order for the United States to then claim its own, they had to be exterminated or driven out. Enormous process of what we would now call ethnic cleansing, let's say. And all in the name of civilization. We're going to bring civilization to these Indians. When John O'Sullivan wrote after our annexation of Texas and on the eve of the war with Mexico, he said it is our manifest destiny to overspread the continent allotted by Providence for the free development of our yearly multiplying millions. So Providence, God. And this theme kept repeated throughout, that God somehow, when we expanded, it was because God wanted us to expand. Some of you may recall, if you learned any of this in history, or maybe even if you read it in my book, that McKinley, President McKinley, when he was making a decision after that quick victory over Spain in the Cuban War, in what is called the Spanish-American War, but what really should be called the Spanish-Cuban-American War, because the Cubans were rebelling against the Spaniards and the United States moved in there to really take away their rebellion and move them out of the way and push the and win the war against Spain, but not allow the Cubans to have the victory over Spain because it was only their country. And now we were going to liberate the Cubans, free the Cubans from Spain, which we did, in fact, but not from us. It's interesting, we freed the Iraqis from Saddam Hussein. True, absolutely, but not from us. And so, this happens again and again. We're always doing these wonderful things for people so that we can then be there and replace their previous conqueror. But when McKinley had a decision about, after the war in Cuba, decision about should we invade the Philippines, Cuba's close, the Philippines are very far, although McKinley actually didn't know where the Philippines were, you see. But we're accustomed to presidents not knowing where things are, you know. What language do they speak in Latin America? Latin. Isn't that what Bush said at one time? But McKinley said that it helped him to decide about the Philippines. He got down on his knees and prayed, and God told him to take the Philippines. Well, how can we dispute that? If God tells you something privately, I mean, how can anybody say no? And so God told McKinley to take the Philippines. Of course, the Filipinos did not get the same message. Maybe because they were heathens, you see, and they fought back. The United States fought a bloody war in the Philippines. The war in Cuba had lasted for a few months. The war in the Philippines lasted for years before the United States conquered the Philippines and killed perhaps 600,000 Filipinos in the process. That's a lost episode in American history. You look for a real account of the Philippine War in American history books, you'll find it quickly gone over, passed over. But God, always behind our expansion and our conquest. No. And Bush, of course, has carried that to its farthest limit. And I mean, here's something that appeared in an Israeli newspaper, and I'm not sure if it's true. But there's so many things that you sort of sound incredible, and then you find out, yes. Yeah. I don't really know if it's true, but I'll tell you anyway. I may as well pass this on. If it's not true, okay. But it sort of fits in with everything else about Bush. That according to the Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, Bush had been meeting with Palestinian leaders, and he was talking to, Prime Minister Abbas, and Abbas told this reporter from Haaretz what Bush had said to him. God told me to strike at Al-Qaeda, and I struck them. And then he instructed me to strike at Saddam, which I did. And now I am determined to solve the problem in the Middle East. Actually, I was dubious about this because the sentence is too literate. And too biblical in its rhythm, God told me to do it, except that it sort of fits Bush's notion that God, again and again, tells him to do things. This is more credible. Richard Lamb, the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, says that Bush told him, during the election campaign, I believe God wants me to be president. This was interesting to me. God interfering in an American election? But when somebody quoted this, and somebody reported this, the man, Richard Lamb, said, well, Bush's following sentence was not quoted. After he said, I believe God wants me to be president, Bush said, but if that doesn't happen, it's okay. This was very nice of Bush. that if he's, willing to accept God's judgment, even if it might go against him. But God has been a part of this administration, you know. That is, this administration notion of God. This administration's preempting of God. This insufferable arrogance that, you know, that God has hardly anything else to do, you see, but concern himself or herself with a policy, with a foreign policy of the United States, you know, and give advice to the President of the United States. It's a little frightening the way in which religion and God have been used, misused, distorted in order to serve the political needs of this administration. Chief Justice Scalia is one of them, one of the people who invokes God again and again. He invokes God to support the idea of the death penalty. Really? He said, for the believing Christian, death is no big deal. That's interesting. You know, what are you getting excited about, putting people to death? For Christians, it's, you know, not a problem. You know, that is, for this Christian, for Scalia, it's not a problem, and therefore it's not a problem for the believing Christian, you say. But this notion of expanding liberty, democracy in the world, and that the United States has the duty, the responsibility to do this, is not just a belief of sort of right-wing fundamentalists. It has, for much of American history, down to the present day, been accepted by people who are considered liberals. In fact, there's a connection between this belief in liberalism and the belief that, well, if you're a liberal country, you have the responsibility to spread liberalism around the world. And so you find that that it isn't just Bush and the fundamentalist right, but liberal presidents, as well as conservative presidents, have basically followed the same foreign policy. If you look at the history of the Vietnam War, it didn't divide along liberal-conservative lines, didn't divide along Republican-Democratic lines, whether you had a Republican in the White House or a Democrat in the White House. You know, from, you know, Kennedy and Johnson through Nixon and Ford, Republicans or Democrats, they followed a consistent pattern in trying to impose the American military domination of Vietnam. And you find that in the Clinton administration, you know, there's very, people are alarmed when in a year after 9/11 in September of 2002, Bush laid out what is called a national security strategy for the United States and said, you know, the United States should have the right to intervene militarily in other countries unilaterally, without the rest of the world going along, without the United Nations going along. We have the right to do that. And we have the right not to wait until somebody is attacked or some act of aggression is taking place. We have the right to act preemptively in advance of something being done to justify our military attack. And he said another part of the national security strategy, you know, we need to be the dominant military power in the world. Nobody should be allowed to come close to our military dominance in the world. Well, this is chilling to a lot of people. I mean, unilateralism, forget about international law, forget about the United Nations. Forget about that whole idea that came at the end of World War II. You know that if there's a serious problem in the world, that the nations will deal with it collectively. That no one nation should arrogate to itself the right to decide what is just and what is unjust in the world. But it was not just, you know, this was shocking. But actually, the same ideas had been laid out earlier by the Clinton administration and acted on. The Clinton administration also acted preemptively when it felt that it should do so, and without the support of the rest of the world, without the support of the United Nations. One of the first things that Clinton did when he came into office was to send bombers over Baghdad. Didn't wait for any international body to say, well, this is the thing to do. And it wasn't that Baghdad was attacking anybody. No, it all had to do with the supposition, which was never proved, that there'd been an assassination attempt against Bush Sr. And Clinton was, I guess, showing his friendship and his generosity to the elder Bush by bombing Baghdad to show, you know, that he wasn't going to take this possibility lying down. And some of you may recall that Madeleine Albright at one point said, and talk about, you know, this idea of unilateralism, she said, the United States will act collectively if possible, unilaterally if necessary. Liberals and conservatives. A lot of people forget that it was Clinton who raised the specter of weapons of mass destruction as a reason for bombing Iraq. This is before, this is not a full-scale war. This is just a series of bombings of Iraq on the basis of the possession of weapons of mass destruction, which nobody was absolutely sure about and clear about. This is an old story in American history of liberal, supposedly liberal presidents on the question of American expansion. They were together with the conservatives, the Democrats and the Republicans. And Woodrow Wilson was a clear example of this. And you know, even to this day in college courses and university courses, Woodrow Wilson is presented as, you know, the idealist and the person who sort of believes in sort of international cooperation and self-determination. Well, of course, Wilson was a perfect example of the liberal believing that it was the God-given right of a liberal nation to spread its liberalism around the world by force, if necessary. And the idea was that, you know, we are different than other nations. When we go to war, when we use force, we do it for liberalism and for democracy. And Wilson is remembered in history, he fathered the League of Nations. He believed in self-determination. Yeah, he was a humane and liberal man. And what is lost in history is Wilson's bombardment of the Mexican coast in 1914. Wilson's sending of a military force into Haiti to occupy Haiti in 1915, an occupation that lasted and lasted and lasted, an occupation which the Haitians resisted, and in the course of it, several thousand Haitians were killed by the armed forces of the United States. Or Wilson's dispatch of troops to the Dominican Republic to occupy the Dominican Republic in 1916. They occupied it, you know, for the next 8 or 10 years. And my point is that we mustn't, in our assessment of the Bush administration, come to the conclusion that if we will just elect a Democrat instead of a Republican, a liberal instead of conservative, that the United States will suddenly give up its long historic infatuation with expansion and with violent expansion. One of the things that that this leads to, this notion that the United States is different, the United States is exceptional, the United States has a right to do things that other nations don't do. We have, one of the results of this, that the United States simply exempts itself from the what are considered the normal and moral obligations in the world that are established by the United Nations Charter, that are established by the Geneva Convention, that are established by the the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And so, so the United States then, while over 100 nations will sign a treaty banning landmines, the United States says, we're not going to sign the treaty banning landmines. There are 100 million landmines in the world, lying buried, and thousands of people die sort of every month as a result of these landmines. I just met recently an Italian war surgeon, a man named Gino Strada, wrote a book which isn't very much known in this country, but it's a book about his experience as a war surgeon working for 15 years in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Somalia, in Rwanda, in Pakistan, and taking care of, doing surgery, mostly on children who have been the victims of landmines that are buried in the earth, and children are going out, terrible things happen. So the United States refuses to sign it. The United States refuses to put any strength into the Biological Weapons Convention. Here's the United States all incensed about Saddam Hussein having possible chemical and biological weapons, which you haven't been able to find, but the United States doesn't want to sign a convention which other nations have agreed to and try to enforce the restriction against biological weapons. We are exempt from that. We are exempt from the Geneva Conventions about torture, about the use of napalm, about the use of cluster bombs. We refuse to join the International Court of Criminal Justice to bring to trial people who commit crimes against humanity. Oh, the United States, we don't do that. These rules shouldn't apply to us. When Madeleine Albright had made that statement about how the United States, if necessary, should act unilaterally, Henry Kissinger responded to that by saying, "That's true, yes, but this principle should not be universalized." We can do it, but other countries cannot. And the United States believes that it has the lone responsibility to hunt down terrorists in the world, and to hunt them down, presumably, by making war on countries that the United States has in some way designated as deserving of military action, perhaps because Al-Qaeda is hiding in the mountains somewhere, and therefore we bomb the country. We bomb Afghanistan. We kill thousands of people in Afghanistan because Osama bin Laden is somewhere in the country. If there's a criminal hiding out in your neighborhood, then the police should come and bomb the neighborhood, right? The criminal will probably escape, just as Osama bin Laden did, right? And in the course, so it's a strange way of thinking that we have the right to do this. We are being told by God to deal with terrorism, and surely if there is a God and he is just and he is wise, he understands that war is terrorism. War is the highest form of terrorism. That the terrorism of groups, of bands, of people like Al-Qaeda or like the IRA or Palestinian suicide bombers, that terrorism is small compared to the terrorism of war. Nations are capable, really, nations are, you know, nations are capable of committing terrorist acts on a far larger scale than any individuals or groups in a society are capable of. And the irony is that these war acts of terrorism are supposed to be doing away with terrorism, when in fact, not only are they terrorism, but they increase the number of terrorists in the world by increasing the number of people in the world who become ferociously angry at the United States.